I'm delighted to welcome Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the phys ed column for the New York Times, and she is an award-winning journalist who's had pieces in New York Magazine, the Oprah Magazine, and many others. She lives here in Santa Fe, and her new book, already a bestseller, is called The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer. Welcome.
My pleasure.
So we're all going to live to be 99. If we exercise?
Ideally. There actually is really good science showing that being active at any level, and that means 20 minutes of moving around a day, actually does demonstrably increase people's lifespan. And it also decreases the risk for diabetes, heart disease, dementia, just about all the really bad diseases.
And even cancer.
Oh, cancer, very definitely. It actually has a pretty significant effect, they have found. Activity levels seem to reduce the risk, especially of breast cancer, secondarily of colon cancer, and also of lung cancer. So, I mean, it's a pretty significant benefit if you just move a little bit.
One of the things that you start your book with is this idea that we are not born to run. We human beings are born to walk. We do much better at walking than at running.
Yes, and there is a very strong myth out there about the fact that humans need to run. But our ancestors almost certainly walked most of the time. It's much more efficient if you're hunting animals to walk behind them and let them tire themselves out. And then you move in and spear them. And that is actually what modern hunter-gatherers do as well.
How can you catch up with a gazelle if you're walking?
Well, what appeared to happen back then, and also does happen in modern hunter-gatherer societies, what the few that exist, is that humans would run for brief periods of time and then walk, and then run and then walk. They were moving the whole time, but the human body is much more efficient, meaning it uses less oxygen when it walks. So we are really built to walk and to keep it up. We can keep it up a lot longer than a gazelle can run. And that's really what allowed the human species to thrive, was the ability to just keep moving. And not fast, but just keep moving.
And so movement turns out to be, in itself, one of the things that keeps us healthy. Sedentary lifestyle, no matter what you eat, is not really that good for you. And yet, you don't need that much movement. It's not like you need to exercise an hour and a half every day.
Not at all. The human genome really was built back in the hunter-gatherer age, and it has changed very little, which is interesting. That means that our DNA, every cell in your body works better when you move. When you don't, the science has found things start changing within your body very quickly. If you sit for 5 hours at a time, even if you're generally active, you start having changes physiologically in the body that are unhealthy. You start having a fair amount of fat buildup. And that really doesn't matter what diet you eat. It means there are certain enzymes that do not get produced as effectively. Those are the enzymes that break down fat in your blood. If you sit for long periods of time, you don't get those enzymes, you get more fat. That's in the blood. That fat goes to your liver, it goes to your heart, it jumpstarts all sorts of unhealthy consequences. And that does not matter if you then that evening go for a run, it's the period of sitting itself that is unhealthy.
So people whose job, which many of our jobs are, including me, is to sit around, whether it be in a cafe or in an office or whatever, what, should they get up for like a few minutes every day and just do jumping jacks?
You can even skip the jumping jacks. There is a very modern phenomenon called the active couch potato, and many of us
pick up the remote?
Well, but I actually, what that means is it's people like me who set aside half an hour or so a day to exercise. And I do that. I run just about every day. I don't run fast. I don't run hard, but I run. Then we sit the entire rest of the day. We're active couch potatoes. And that's extremely unhealthy, as it turns out, because exercise has benefits, but sitting for a really long period of time has consequences that the exercise does not undo. Exactly.
So what are you supposed to do?
Stand up. And it's...
Just stand up. Just stand up and go to the refrigerator?
You don't even have to go to the refrigerator. That's it. Actually, try not to go to the refrigerator. There have been some very good studies showing standing up about every 20 minutes makes a big difference physiologically. And that's because if you sit for a long period of time, the big muscles in your leg and back, which are the biggest muscles in your body, don't contract. If your muscles don't contract, they don't use blood sugar. So you get blood sugar, you get fatty buildup in your blood, you get all these things from just sitting. If you stand up, those muscles have to contract. Doesn't matter if you're doing jumping jacks, doesn't matter if you walk around. If you just stand up, those muscles contract. That actually causes physiological changes that will improve your health. The science has shown if you stand up about 2 minutes every 20 minutes, you don't get the really severe consequences of sitting.
Fascinating. Now, one of the things that I was thinking about when reading your book is there's a continual quest on the part of science, with a capital S, of science to figure out what's the optimal amount, what's the optimal exercise for people. But people are so different. I mean, some people love to run. You look at people who are just natural runners. You don't want them to be walking. They should be running. They love it. Some people love to pole vault. Some people, walking around is enough for them. And I know people are perfectly healthy, who've never done really any exercise, but they walk everywhere they go. Never joined a gym. People who live in New York City, plenty of people like that. I mean, how can there be a one-size-fits-all for this great variation from one person to another, from one group to another?
One of the most interesting things that I've found in researching exercise science is that they are slowly learning how differently people respond to different types of exercise. And it appears to be genetic. Yes, the human body is built to move. There is no doubt about that at all. However, one person's best response to activity will be different than someone else's. There have been some interesting studies where they looked at people where they had some people run, they had some people weight train, they had some people do both. And what they found is some of the people got a lot fitter, whether they ran or lifted weights. Some people didn't get more fit. Some people got less fit. And that seems to be strictly because of your genetic makeup. So look at your parents. Are they good runners? Then you probably will be. If they seem to be bulky, if they have a certain amount of muscles, it's possible you will be better at sprinting things, at lifting things, at some other type of activity. The main lesson, though, is in one way or another, your body is built to be active. You do need to find the way that you enjoy and that you do respond to, and it will not be exactly the same as your neighbors. It may not be the same as the person you start a training program with. That person may do really well and you may not, so find something else.
And it's difficult in the United States. It's even difficult in a place like Santa Fe, where, I mean, I don't care what anybody says, the bicycling situation here is a disaster. There's so many things blocking the bike lanes all the time, and public space isn't really set up for pedestrians or for bicyclists in general.
It's not. And I mean, I live here in Santa Fe, so I can say without a doubt, it's not really a pedestrian-friendly city, although it's generally an active city, much more active than is the American norm, where more than a third of people do nothing. Certainly Santa Fe is not on that level of inactivity. There's so many things that we could have here that would really encourage more activity. We need more sidewalks. We need better parks. We certainly need better bike lanes. We probably need better drivers.
We need better drivers and driver education about bicyclists, no doubt.
Yes, and just across the board, not just in Santa Fe, but throughout America, we need a better public policy impetus to get people out and moving.
You know what would probably be the best public policy impetus to get people moving? Double the minimum wage.
There are some experiments to have insurance rates set to whether you are moving. This is my personal opinion. I'm not in favor of saying you have to, quote unquote, exercise a certain period of time, because that can be really intimidating to a lot of people who think exercise in and of itself is hard. If you redefine that to being just active, if you count things like gardening, like walking around the block, if you make sure that those things count, then if you offer people incentives, and that includes monetary incentives, they have found that people will do it.
I mean monetary incentives in the sense of people are exhausted and overworked, and so many people work two jobs, and so many people are wage earners and are still exhausted and don't even have time to run around with their kids or have any leisure time.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And then that does have an effect on the younger generation. As you just said, they don't have time to run around with their kids. And what we're seeing in America, and I'm sure we would probably find it in Santa Fe, is activity levels in America peak at the age of 7.
What?
And they start declining, and in adolescence, they fall off a cliff. Adolescent girls, about a year or so earlier than adolescent boys, they start essentially becoming complete couch potatoes. It's not active couch potatoes. They really become almost inactive, and from then on, become even less active.
Well, speaking of gender, I noticed as I was reading your book that so many of the studies that you cite in exercise science are done on male athletes or even male mice.
Yes.
I mean, what? This is the stuff that drove everybody crazy. They would only study men and in terms of like heart disease, and then suddenly they figured out after years that women's hearts, heart attacks and all that were different. What is going on? I found it offensive.
I'm a woman, and yes, I find it offensive and frustrating. And also, what it does do is skew the information.
Yeah.
Because when they then do look at women, for instance, this is a somewhat technical topic, but carbo loading. Carbo loading is very famous. You do it before you run a marathon. You basically eat pasta, lots and lots of, exactly, lots and lots of carbohydrates with the assumption that loads up your muscles so you have more fuel. Well, as it turns out, that doesn't work in women. It doesn't work all that well in men. A lot of that was mythology, but it really doesn't work in women. So when they finally got around to studying it, what they found was it just made women gain lots and lots of water weight. So you got to the starting line of the marathon just weighing a lot, not being in any way more ready to run. So they do need, if they're going to do exercise studies, to look at both men and women, either together or separately. And they also need to look at kids, because kids are not just little people, little humans, little adults. They are completely separate physiologically, and they cannot do some of the same things.
We're talking to Gretchen Reynolds about her new book, The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Now, there's a funny dialectic in your book between, on the one hand, follow your common sense, and on the other hand, all this exercise science is revealing things that are completely counterintuitive.
Well, I'm not sure I agree they're counterintuitive. I think
chocolate milk.
Well, that one, that may be counterintuitive, but I really like it. And that, if you actually look at that, it is common sense. You just have to know what's going on in your muscles. If you have exercised hard, and that means you really have to have exercised for at least an hour vigorously, not just an easy walk. An easy walk is great. It's not going to use up your fuel sources in your muscles.
To the point where you merit a glass of chocolate milk.
Exactly. What does happen after a vigorous workout is you have both used up the fuel in your muscles and you've slightly torn all of the muscles. They will then rebuild themselves and be stronger. That's the whole point of that kind of exercise. But they need fuel and they need a certain amount of protein to do that. Chocolate milk this is scientifically proven, actually has an ideal ratio of carbohydrates to protein, the sugars to the protein. So if you can drink milk, and some people can't, some people don't want to, but it's...
Well, some are lactose intolerant.
Exactly. And there are people, I mean, there are issues about whether chocolate or whether milk is good for people, but that's a different issue. If you are going to have a recovery beverage after a hard workout, you don't need some fancy tiger's milk or anything. Chocolate milk is perfect.
There are other things in the book that are very interesting, and that is to get the same benefit, you could exercise moderately for an hour, hour and a half, or you could exercise very intensely for a minute, and then another minute, and then a few more minutes, and you put together those minutes, and by the time a half an hour has gone by with warming up and cooling down and everything, you have just as much benefit as if you'd exercised moderately for a longer time, but those individual minutes are no fun.
Exactly. It's called high-intensity interval training. And I should start by saying it's essentially a workout that you should only approach if you want to get more fit. And if you just want to be healthy, don't worry about it. You don't have to do super intense intervals of any kind. Just walk.
What's the difference between fit and healthy?
There actually is a significant difference. Healthy essentially is about avoiding disease risk, improving your lifespan, doing things to make sure that your body is functioning well. Fitness is actually different. It really means you're improving your body's ability to move oxygen through your blood. You're making yourself better able to perform athletically. But that's not the same thing as just being healthy.
So handstand push-ups fall into the...
I would say you don't have to do those to be healthy. But
we had to do those the other day at the gym.
If you can do them, that's great. I mean, it certainly suggests a level of fitness. And if you do want to be fit and you do want to perhaps be competitive and you don't have a lot of time, high-intensity intervals are great. And you can do it very, very easily on your own. They've shown that doing something like going as hard as you can for 1 minute, and you know if you're going hard. You don't need a heart rate monitor. You don't need fancy formulas. Just be honest with yourself.
You just start to feel awful.
Yeah, you feel awful. Just do that for a minute and time it, and then do something easy for a minute. Don't stop altogether. If you're running, just jog easily. If you're on a bicycle, dial
slow
back.
Down,
exactly.
Yeah.
For another minute, do that 10 times. That's 20 minutes of the actual workout with maybe 5 minutes of warm-up, cool-down. That's a very potent exercise regimen.
What are some of the myths about exercise in the body that you have come across that turn out, at least in as far as we've gotten in current exercise science? And I say this because one of the things that I think drives people crazy is that a study is done that shows that something is true, and then another study overturns it, and 2 weeks later another study overturns that. But okay, what are some of the myths that we now think are untrue?
Well, one is about stretching, and when I wrote about stretching in the Times, it was actually the same weekend as Barack Obama was elected president, and the story I wrote about stretching bumped his election from the top of the most emailed list on the Times.
No.
Yes, for a week and a half.
Oh, my goodness. That's telling.
People are very passionate about their stretching routines. But when they have been looked at scientifically, when they have brought people into the laboratory and actually looked at what goes on when you do static stretching, which is what most of us do before a workout or we were taught to do.
Touch your toes.
Touch your toes. Hold it. Hold it for 30 seconds or so. That actually makes muscles less ready to perform by and large. It actually makes the mind think you're about to rip that muscle. And you get what's called a neuromuscular inhibitory response, where the brain actually tells the muscle to tighten so it will not overstretch. You are then actually less ready to work out if you stretch before a workout. It's much better if you're going to stretch to do it afterwards. And for a lot of people, they're not going to get more flexible no matter what. Most of flexibility, science is showing pretty clearly, is genetic. And you can stretch and stretch and stretch, and it will feel good. And if you have injuries, that's different. But just to make yourself more flexible, stretching is not going to do as much as we think it's going to do.
Now, what about yoga, which is, I'm sorry, it's really good.
No, yoga is
not that
fabulous.
I enjoy it, but it's so good for you.
Yoga is good for you. It's good for the muscles. It's good for the brain, which is not a minor thing. If you actually, they have brought people in before and after yoga classes, and what tends to happen in terms of their flexibility is there's a brief window in which their muscles are slightly more able to be elastic, then that goes away pretty quickly. So if you are looking to yoga to actually make yourself more flexible in the really long term, it's not clear scientifically whether that is happening. If it makes you feel better, if it makes you feel more relaxed, then and it does definitely make you stronger. Those things are really important, and it's great.
Let's talk for a moment about the brain. How do we, through exercise, become happy and smart?
Actually, I have to say the science that I've researched about exercise in the brain is probably what keeps me running every day.
Because even though you're not born to run, you like to run.
Yes, I like to run partly because you can get it done quickly. And I also walk when I'm tired. But the studies about what exercise does to the brain really are profound. There's a portion of the brain called the hippocampus that controls both your memory and mood. It's the most important part of the brain for both of those elements. It shrinks with age. It starts shrinking when we're in our 20s. If, however, you exercise, you build new brain cells there. And that's another myth. Many people still think we don't build new brain cells over the course of our life. Well, you do, even if you don't exercise. You create new brain cells throughout your lifespan. You will double the number of brain cells that you create if you exercise. And that includes walking.
Yeah.
There have been really good studies showing 30 minutes a day of walking will double the number of brain cells you create in your hippocampus.
Does that include strolling?
Yes, actually.
Really?
Well,
because I sometimes am so tired and those dogs need a walk, and I just take them, and I cannot even get up, work up any kind of a sweat or walk briskly. So I'm just strolling the dogs. That counts?
It absolutely counts. Any amount of movement counts. And the idea that exercise has to be hard, strenuous, even brisk to count is just a myth. You will have changes in your body if you just stand up and walk to the window. You will probably, just in that little tiny bit of activity, spark a few more brain cells.
I read somewhere that there was actually a measurable decline in the health of television watchers when they invented the remote control.
Yes, there was, actually.
You actually had to get up to turn the channel.
Yes, and it's really too bad. There also have been measurable increases in childhood obesity tied to a growing number of TVs in kids' bedrooms with a remote. And anything that encourages people to sit, there actually are really good statistics about the effect of television watching on longevity. I think I mentioned in the book, if you are past the age of 40, there are statistics that suggest that for every hour of television you watch, you shave 22 minutes off your lifespan.
Goodness.
So a woman, in more practical terms, what they have discovered is that a man can add about 2 years to his lifespan if he watches next to no television after the age of 40. Television is a measure, essentially, of sitting. And a woman can probably add a year and a half to her lifespan if she just sits less.
Good heavens. Well, much more to talk about, but it's time to go. Gretchen Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times, and she is an award-winning journalist, published in many magazines. Her new book is called The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.